And it is recording. Perfect. Okay. So I'm dealing with tweens. The first thing I kind of wanted to talk about is what I call the crazy years. This starts really for many kids now at eight or nine years old, really. And the adolescent changes, those tween changes start coming. And as parents, it'd be wise for you to get ahead of the tsunami that's getting ready to hit. And not only for yourselves, but to give them a heads up about the changes to their bodies, their emotions, their brain, and even just spiritual questions they start having, even if they had already come to Christ. So you need to be the safe, steady place that questions can be asked, no matter how crazy they are or how illogical they are, or even posed as you see them going through this confusion of this time. One of the things you want to give them a heads up about, obviously, and I'm not going to go into detail on this because there can be hours of this, is just that as they're growing up, their bodies are going to be changing a lot, that they have been gifted uniquely by God. So as their giftings are, so are their bodies, that will mature at different rates and different ways, just as God intended. And just fill them in on, there's this new thing happening in your body called hormones, and the body is newly making them. That is the engine behind a lot of this change that you're seeing physically, and how you're feeling and how you're thinking. Research has found that both sexes have hormonal changes up to 50 times the normal adult levels during this time. Can you imagine? Does that kind of not set the context for why all the crazy's going on in them? It'd be like premenopause, or you know, when you're in pregnancy or right after you have a baby, the hormone changes aren't even anywhere near this 50 times. So ask questions. Don't make statements. Coach on the new skills that they need now. Like, you're probably going to have to take a shower at least once a day. If you go play and work out, you probably have to take two showers. Talk about deodorant, all those things. If you bring them up first, they are not going to feel like this weirdo that all of a sudden has these things happening. They think they're the only one. There is no shame in how our bodies are changing, but it is personal, and it is a wonderful gift that God's given them to mature them physically to be an adult. Talk about your own experiences to help them normalize things that you thought, things you did, stupid things that you know, that you yourself did, to help them see, oh, okay, I'm not the only one here. Be prepared for emotions all over. For boys and girls, the hormones also play a big role in this. So giving grace and holding on to learning how to still love and do relationships right is going to be a tension you are going to have to help them manage. Because though they were doing relationships before well during this time, it's going to be harder, and you'll see it. There's confusion, sadness, anger, irritability, overreaction, and it can be so confusing to them because they oftentimes don't even know where it's coming from. And they're looking around for somebody to blame, and usually it's going to be the parent or the adult around them. We can't change those feelings, but we can remember their new changes need our listening ear. When they want to talk, when they want to talk, or help us, or maybe even help talk them down off of a cliff that they have no idea how they got there. Like things like, can you tell me what's going on? What are you thinking? What happened that you think, you know, got you here? And one of the things that I was reminded of in this book that I'm sharing over there is that Satan has a huge weapon during this time. Probably one of the biggest stages of life where he really uses his power, because he can use this to make them feel like their upside down feelings tell them that they're the only one. They feel isolated. They're weird. No one understands me. You don't even love me right now. Nobody loves me. The research said that often child-parent relationships start fraying during this time, as Satan takes the opportunity to break that trust bond. Many point to this time when parents, this particular time frame, when parents and children grew distant or apart because of all the turmoil that's going on in the home. So it's our role to lean in, love, ask to listen, and not respond in hurt or anger by some of the things that come out of their mouths or their actions at this new morphing child adult. when there is unresolved conflict, we need to make sure that we've asked them, did we do something wrong? Is there something I need to apologize for? Give them that open door, because that's a new ground for them and they need to have that voice to say that. So this is open, because this opens the door to them to be able to talk. It allows us to release control and give freedom to them practicing their adulting under our protection and coaching. Proverbs 25:28 says, if we can't control our temper, our emotions, we are like a city with no walls. We can't protect ourselves, and anyone can force us into an emotional storm or a battle. So we want to work at, set the pace at, not letting their emotions, they're crazy, control our reactions, but instead be a calm, steady presence. One quick touch on the intellectual, the brain changes, because this was an aha moment for me during this time. It goes with the other two. There's a lot of changes in the brain, and the main part that neurologists say changes during this time is the executive function, which, if you need an explanation, that's the center for common sense and good judgment. It is coming unwound and redoing, and there's so many aha moments I had when I read that for this time frame. What was a normally fairly sensible child, now, like, they're completely illogical at times, and those neurons reassemble into their adult configuration during this time. But in the meantime, there's a loss of focus, problem solving, etc. Just the things that they were good at before, they will often regress a bit for a couple of years even. So how do we deal with this? Patients having their full attention when we give them instruction, so that we know they're hearing us and giving them then the ability to follow through that. They may regress, but we still need to hold the vision for them that they're going to move past this and keep giving them responsibilities with a little bit of oversight. During this time, it's going to be, you're going to want to hold on tighter because of their crazy, because it makes sense to you, but do not tighten that grip. It won't help. The next thing I want to talk about real quickly is just during this time, encouraging their strengths and helping them work on weaknesses. And the goal is to help them know that we see and like them just the way they are right now. But we are also excited to see what God is going to do in and through them as they grow in hearing and being the best, fill in the blank with your child's name. Because we're trying to help them be the best that shot, the best Melinda, the best Karen, not the best whomever else, the best, because that's who God created them to be. We can do this. The best way to do this is using the Bible's principles and Bible's wisdom to really get to know and continue to know our child or children and cooperate with God in his vision of who they are. Proverbs 22:6 comes to mind about just training them the way they should go. And one way we can train towards, or we can coach to, is 1 Corinthians 13:11, because this is kind of the goal. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put away childish things behind me. Not the innocence, not the lack of guile, none of that, but just thinking like a man or a woman. I'm sure you've seen your child grow and mature in so many ways as they're developing. They have their own opinions now, their preferences, their talents, their giftings, doing things their own way. But there's still a lot of maturity in their thinking, as we just talked about, decision making, even communicating what they're thinking, especially in these tween years. But you have opportunity to recognize and encourage their strengths and help them see as they work on things that they're thinking, or maybe even a weakness is contributing to their frustration in an area that's not being done well, or they just can't even seem to do it at all. Proverbs 26:11 says, even children are known by the way they act, whether their conduct is pure, whether it is right. So asking God, is this conduct a toe-to-toe, you know, disobedience to God, or is it just confusion and needing to some help to find a way? Asking God to see the heart of our tween makes it a possibility to turn the mirror to them now, not just ourselves, not just our feedback, but turn to them and help them discover where they chose well and then what they might want to work on the next time. To live out of their strengths, we can help them observe those and point to them. And this can open the door that they'll be open to balancing the weaknesses that they have so they don't shoot themselves in the foot, at least not a whole lot of times. An example is one of our kids, we became aware over time that his strength was doing things with excellence, all the small details. What we couldn't put together for a while is it seemed though that he was almost being disobedient. We'd ask him to do something and he'd kind of have like an emotional meltdown and he'd get halfway through it and then just not finish, and or say he couldn't finish it, or we could just see the frustration. And being how I'm wired and being how Neil's wired, we were seeing him through our strengths and weaknesses, and we have to be sure that we're not focusing on our own preferences because of our strengths or weaknesses, that we're seeing him through that, you know, those glasses. And I kept watching him and I finally realized, you know, we both can do things fairly quickly, but I am very detail oriented. So that will slow me down as I'm trying to think through all the details of things. And I talked to Neil one day and we talked about it. And I said, maybe if you give him a little more time out, you say, hey, I need you to have this done by noon instead of in the next 10 minutes, get this done. If it doesn't have to be, let's give him some time to live out of his strength. And so Neil one day asked me to clean up the lawnmower. And he had his expectation. Maya told him what he wanted to look like. And he left and he came back and Micah was doing something. He said, did you clean the lawnmower? He goes, yeah, I did. And he gave him the whole morning. He went out and looked at it. He said, it looked like I had never used the lawnmower. There was no grass, no oil, no dirt. Everything was shined up. It was beautiful. And then he said it hit him. And as we talked, it hit both of us. Okay, so here's his strength. Let's ask him to do things in those strengths. But also over time, helping with the weakness of you can't have half a day to do a project like that eventually. So we began to over time, just give him way heads up, but then shorten the time a little at an ill increment so that he could adapt that weakness of just needing all this time and thinking and creativity. Does that give you an illustration? We learned that we, when they don't do things like we do, we can react and lecture and assume before really listening to them. So James 1:19 reminds us to be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. Stop talking. Begin now asking clarifying questions of why something makes sense to them in that process. Then when they feel heard, when they think we hear and see them, they're going to be much more apt to talk to us. We're listening to understand them, not to get our point across. That's more of what we're doing right now. We want them to know that we're on their team, that we just want to coach them a little, help have some influence, not control. We are taking away control. Look for and acknowledge your strength in the situation, whether it's diligence, heart to obey, you know, working with excellence. Over communicate that character trait or strength that we see in them. Tell others in front of them what you saw them do or how they contributed. This was a huge failing on my part. I am not wired to need verbal affirmation. I just don't need it. And I miss so many opportunities to have what I was thinking in my head was they're amazing. They did such a great job, but I didn't say it. And I finally learned they need this to keep moving forward. They need this to take on their responsibility at where they are. And I need to consciously look for things to do. And there again, we learn ourselves from things like that. And so when a weakness has shown up in the process of hearing and giving responsibilities, when you have encouraged them and talked about what they're doing well, you have the heart of that one that's been encouraged when you actually have to have harder conversations about, you know, where they're not taking their responsibility well. Give them room to try things that they haven't tried. to build on the strengths and develop ways to accommodate the weakness. Our encouragement to do those things, to try them, and to, even if you mess up, is much better in our home under our coaching, then they're going to want to try things and prove themselves out there with not the, you know, the oversight that you have at home. Deal with patterns of wrongdoing, not just random things that they're going to do. Make sure you're just dealing with a pattern. Look for truth and grace. So next question and final is, where are you headed in this season of tweens? One analogy that I found that I loved was, it's like sailing on an ocean. Now, I personally have not sailed a boat. I've only been on boats that are sailing. But I know, like sailing, there is not a perfect equation to parenting, because God made us unique. God made that child unique. There is a course, though, that God has for all of us that is set on His principles for training kids to honor Him and bless others. That's where we're headed, to honor Him, bless others. We will have to keep adjusting the sails and begin to hand them more and more responsibility of navigating that, to adjust for the changing tides, the wind, the storms, the really sunny days, and everything in between as you get towards that destination. And on that journey is going to look different with each child. So the goal is to begin now, handing over more and more of their freedom to them. The destination, this is where we're going to end up when we step off on the other side, is a planned emancipation that is in full swing by the time they're 18. They are completely in charge of their lives by the time they're 18. Now, you can't hand that to them at 17.9 months. It has to be gradually handed to them. You were training and keeping tight boundaries on them in these prior years. Now's the time for them to take responsibility for more of their lives while we can coach and redirect when they get lost. The overarching atmosphere is we want to create is that we're here for you, but we are going to continue to hand you responsibilities more and more over to you. You give them more choices in every area you can, and keep growing those areas with their age and the responsibility they take. You know, one idea that was suggested, I don't think in this book, but another person I read, was to start with the basic list of freedoms that you're going to give them. Just make a list with them. Say, this is now what you have the expectations, the responsibilities that go with that freedom, and the natural consequence that will happen should they not handle that freedom well. For an example, you know, you say, okay, from now on, I've shown you how to clean your room. I've shown you how to put things up. I've shown you how to organize it. I've shown you what they need to do in here. It is now yours to do. You're responsible for it. I will not come in and fix your stuff. But if you don't use those skills in a good way, you will have the consequences of, if there's ants that come trailing into your bedroom because you left food and dirty dishes on the floor, then you're going to be spending extra time cleaning it up, possibly even paying me to have an exterminator come in to clean up the ants. If you have such a mess in your room that it's time to go to practice or a sports game and you can't find your dirty outfit because you may be late or you may miss it completely. I've pulled up in front of the high school once or twice with one of my children, watched them look at me, know I was there, give them a little grace to talk to their friends. And after multiple conversations, when I did it the second time, I pulled up, he looked at me, I gave him 5 minutes, I left. He called and said, with his friend's phone, where are you going? I'm going home. But you left me. I said, I did. We talked about this. I'll see you at home. And they walked home. So it's not saving them in those times when they know their freedom, their responsibility, and the consequences. Their freedom should grow with their age so that they can bear the weight of being ready to adult when it's time to leave. During this freedom giving season, you can continue to ask them if they want or need some more training with their responsibilities. You can ask things like, so how are you liking living in your own room that you take care of? Does it feel like a refuge, or are you a little depressed when you walk in there? You can ask those questions and begin to help them form what, you know, be honest with themselves. Tweens and teens have a deep need to see others believe they're growing up and they can handle responsibility. Though they themselves are one day sure they can, and the next day they have no idea if they can, we can be the adults who believe in them and help hold the sails in the directions that help them navigate this. Home can be the place they test and refine their skills and prove themselves. If it's not there, again, like I said, it leaves them to prove themselves outside of our home. And the freedom to fail and then make it right should be the culture of our home. A big motivation of your child is to point out how they're contributing, even to your family. Like, you know, your son or daughter went in and took all the dishes off the table and ran in and rinsed them from the dishwasher or whatever as you're getting the siblings out the door for a ball game or maybe a recital. And it's a big win when they do something they to help without being forced to, but they just do it. So we want to be sure we applaud it and look hard for those things and talk about them. An example of just walking through expectations that you're now handing them, this is just one example, would be like in relationship conflicts. We need to clearly communicate and set rules of engagement, for instance, in conflict. Like, number one, our goal in our relationships here in our home is to glorify God and restore relationships. If there's a wrong to be corrected, there needs to be restitution made, forgiveness given, all a part of this. There is no name calling unless that particular sibling or person likes that name that you're calling them. The person is not the problem. It's their words or actions. What did they say or do? Help them to take on the responsibility of asking, saying, they are whatever, but what did they do or say that is frustrating you? Because we can address that. We can't throw the person out. Don't express your anger physically at one another, physical objects, the doors, the walls, whatever. One idea they had in there is they had a lot of boys and they told them one of their suggestions is when you're angry, put your hands down. They're usually going to go up. If you're a boy, you're going to do something physical. Just put them down when you're angry and give yourself a chance to breathe. No extortion or blackmail, like I'm telling mom or dad, or you don't love me, that's why you're treating me this way. Those are not okay. Have one fight at a time. Don't pull in offenses from way back. Don't you always just deal with the issue at hand and get to all the way to the end of and conclude it. Follow Matthew 18. If you've been offended by someone, this is now their responsibility, not yours. You go to them privately and not mom or dad, and you give them a chance to make it right. If they don't reconcile it, you can take along another witness, another sibling, another friend, and talk to them again. If that still doesn't work, then you can go to an authority like mom or dad or whoever you happen to be with. But when they come to you asking for help, part of their responsibility now is to make sure that they have talked with their sibling or whoever it is they had a problem with. Then they'll begin to resolve and address their own issues more and more when they see you are no longer going to take up offense for them. You're not going to fix it for them. and reinforce that an apology does take responsibility and ask for forgiveness. Besides the expectations in the home we create for them to be responsible, we can also expose them to opportunities to impact or give back. And Karen and I were talking about this for all the ages, to bring them along on service projects. Like I heard something about that Dave was going to ask some of the guys if they wanted to take boys to go do something today together to help something. And I thought that's so good for them to be asked to impact, to think outside of themselves, to help a church member move, to help babysit, go on a mission trip where they see how others live and what they're hearing or not hearing about God, to see themselves actively putting the interests of others above their own and contributing is so big in this process right now. And on the other side, Karen pointed out that it's also, that I thought even here, not just in high school, intentionally exposing them to things that, where people are dealing with the consequences of their sin, whether it's skid row, shelters, things like that. Talk about how sad Jesus is for them and that he wants to see them reconciled to him. what kind of choices they could have made that got them there. Or even that other's lack of care for them, our lack of love for somebody that wasn't extended, may have made him vulnerable to Satan and to his lies. So to sum up, the key to helping our tween and teens navigate the waters, become an adult, and navigating the crazy and always changing waters of these teen years is searching for and asking God to give insight to their heart and principles that they can hold on to for life. This is a time when we should be trading parental control to self-control, to move from parent-imposed rules to hearts that are under God's influence. We are moving more into coaching and giving them freedom to make decisions and bear the consequences of that. The fear and control we have that is surely in our hearts. I know it was in mine, that I didn't want to let go of that control and I was afraid of what would happen. We give that to God and we keep praying and praying. Proverbs 9:10 said, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." I was fearful and I really began to ask more desperately than ever for wisdom, for his understanding. Keep asking, keep praying. One of the things that was such a refuge for me during these years is I was asked to become part of a Moms in Touch group. And that doesn't have to be like official, but we got together every Saturday morning and prayed specifically for each other's children and for specific things. And boy, I walked away from there with my heart so much lighter over all the things that accumulated over the week. And then finally, Proverbs 1:27:1, and I would encourage you to do something like that with a friend or two. Unless the Lord builds a house, they labor in vain who build it. And now Karen is going to share about, to start with, I'm going to give you a little background on the stages of the teen years and just kind of the life stage. These are, bear with me, my counseling social work background pulling out here. So Melinda has very well explained the early teen years to you. You know, with the high emotions and the puberty and all that stuff. And that stage can start, like she said, it really depends on when they're hit, like when they're hitting puberty. It's a couple years before. And so it might be 11, it might be 10, it might be 9, you know, you just don't know. But you'll start hearing them be kind of mouthy. and you'll start seeing them be more emotional and such. The mid-teen years is more like 14 to 17. Again, with girls and boys, it's different because girls are more mature than boys in general. And because they go through puberty earlier. They start puberty earlier. And so they'll tend to, you know, girls, you know, definitely at 14 are in the mid-teen years. The boys may be just going through puberty right at that point. So it can kind of vary a little bit. And a mid-teen is typically they're more mobile. They tend to live in the moment rather than planning for the future. As she mentioned, you know, like a 13-year-old, so they've lots of gray matter starting here in the frontal lobes, and they are building on their executive function, but they are like a little adult without experience, and it's kind of like hit and miss, you know, at the beginning. They're not all there yet. It's not all fully formed. And so, their pleasure centers and their risk things and stuff are all there, but their emotion things are all there, but the common sense and the, planning and the, you know, the thinking about what am I going to do, especially in the early teens, it's just not there yet. And it's building. Peer pressure is very strong at this stage. But they want to be taken seriously, as a young adult. They don't want you to see them as a child. And so, there are more disagreements at this stage because they have developed some level of logic and they have more abstract thinking because of this frontal lobes. They have their own opinions than you. Some of their opinions they got in all kinds of places. And you may think, I don't know about that, you know. And they'll probably change their mind later. But They are sometimes able to see the big picture, but they aren't necessarily ready to act on it. Like, for example, if they know they're supposed to get good grades, they know they're supposed to study for this test they have tomorrow, but they may decide to go with their friends anyway in these mid-teen years because they do tend to live in the moment still. One of the things you didn't mention, and I need to go back to this in the early teens, is that you'll know that stage because they don't want to walk with you. They don't want to call you mommy anymore. They want to change it to something more mature.
They want to drop them off the block before.
Yeah, exactly. You'll know you hit the early teens when they're doing that. And they outgrow it. Even by high school, they're a little bit better about that stuff. But in the early teens, they are still, they see themselves. The problem is not that they don't love you, but they see themselves as that's showing that they're a child. It's a sign of I'm a little kid, not you know, big. So then a late teen, that would be like, for girls, you can start seeing it at 17, their senior year, otherwise 18, 19, you know, as they're going off to college. And their cognitive development has made a lot of progress at this point. They're able to look to the future, plan for college. They're looking forward to, you know, job training, whatever they're going to do. They've developed a much more solid idea of their own identity, of who they are. And they're emotionally more stable than the younger teens. They're less outbursts and all that kind of stuff. You don't see that as much. They're able to think about ideas and better at gauging risky behavior than the younger teens are. They're better able to emotionally and physically separate from their family, like going to college. They have more adult-like relationships with their family. The physical growth is more or less complete. The boys may still be getting some height. Then you've got the senior year. Seniors in high school are kind of cocky because they know that they're kind of going off to college and or whatever, they're going off to do whatever they're going to do. They think they're moving out and they think they know it all and you know nothing as a parent. So that's kind of a unique year in itself. I have a quote here from Mark Twain that I've always liked. When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have that old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years. And if you remember your own teen years, you probably remember that you thought your parents were dumb, your parents were old school, and, you know, all those things. One of the most helpful things, actually, is to remember your own teen years to give, so that you then give grace to your teenager. You know, if you remember spending an inordinate amount of time in your room, or if you remember being annoyed, I remember being annoyed at my mother when we'd eat breakfast together. I had a single mom. And being annoyed at the sound of her crunching her cereal. It's like, you know, I was crunching cereal too, but that didn't equate for me. I was a teenager. Okay, so then the life stage questions that teenagers are asking, because they are trying to, this is a period of learning to get to the point of being separate from you. So don't feel unloved. It's a stage that they need to go through. They absolutely need to go through it. So the big question is, who am I? Who am I apart from my family? Who am I personally? Why am I here? What am I good at? What do I believe apart from my parents? That's a big one too. This is a stage when they don't want to be seen as a child, even if they sometimes act like one. During these years, they're not going to agree with you on everything like they did as children. Don't worry about those opinions because they may well change during their teen years or later in life. I noticed that my own daughters, you know, they took some opinions out of textbooks and, you know, school and stuff like that. And, you know, we didn't
worry too much about it. And what happened was that, first of all, some things they drop just because they're trying on things and putting them aside, seeing what about this? And no, well, what about that? No, no. But then other things that my daughters held on to through college, I noticed that when they got to working and paying their own taxes and raising children that they wanted to protect, they really did change their views on things because they were experiencing real life where it was all cerebral kind of opinions prior to that. So don't sweat it too much, you know, unless you're talking about something that's a true spiritual right or wrong. You know, they very well may, you know, change their minds on these things. Because teens are seeking autonomy and a sense of self, they sometimes experiment with dress, with hair, with their personas in order to fit in and find out who they are. This is all part of the process. Because they're very self-focused and they tend to be very insecure because even they don't know what's happening to them, as she had mentioned. Eventually, they will settle down and be true to themselves, their family, and to the Lord. It's a natural life stage that they must go through because at the end of those years, they have to be ready to start their own life, you know, however that's going to look like. teens... from Christian families where they've made maybe a profession of faith as a child. You know, many of your children have come to the Lord and they've even been baptized. Usually in their mid-teens, they have to make a second, more adult-like decision. It doesn't mean they're coming to faith. That they came to faith when that was real. But they have to say, do I really believe it? I need to decide, is this just my faith of my parents or is this mine? Am I going to own it? And so you'll see them. They may have some questions that they need to talk about. And don't worry about it. You just need to process it with them as they ask questions, give them opportunity to hear, you know, get all the input that they need. But you will see, I saw all four of my daughters go through that process and they all came out the other side and they're all still walking with the Lord. But they have to do that. It's my faith. You know, have you ever heard the first chair, concept that you can't have the faith of your parents. You have to have your own faith. And so they have to go through that process as a young adult, teenager at some point. So in light of, this transformation, I also want to talk about things to do. You know, we couldn't, with the time limit that we have, this is obviously going to be just very, you know, cursory look. And so I wanted to just focus on how you interact. We can't go down the roads of what about social media? What about this? And what about that? Because we don't have time. That would be an all day seminar, if not a weekend, you know? And, so I'm looking at six principles of, ways to interact with them. And as mentioned before, your goal is to slowly release and grant independence to your youth. And as I was talking to Bethany, right, I was talking about from you've got an infant that is 100% reliant on you. They will die if you don't take care of them. You basically are, that's your job, is to release all the way through, even when they're two, even when they're three, when they're five, when they're seven. This is not just a job of a 10-year-old or, I mean, of a teenager. It's what's happening all the way through. You're teaching your children to dress themselves. That's a level of independence. You're teaching your children to go to school and to do their schoolwork and to be away from you. And to, you know, at each stage, there's what is appropriate of releasing. At the teen years, it becomes much more obvious because they're actually spending a lot more time away from you and you're entrusting them, with things where you won't know what they're doing. And, you know, a lot of Christian parents, they think they have a lot of control, but when it gets to the teen years, you don't have a lot of control. You think you do, but you don't. You have to trust them. And you have to trust that what you've put in all those years, that it's going to still be there, that what you've put into them is there, and they are going to act on it. So, so I would suggest that, you take some time if you have a spouse, which I think most of you do. I don't know. You don't have, okay. If by yourself or with spouse, that you take time to think about what would you like your 18 or 19 year old to look like? What qualities would you want them to have spiritually? What characteristics in terms of their relationships, their character, their values, their practical skills, their academic skills, all these different areas? What do you want to see? And then you have to work backwards. What do we need to do today? What do we need to start doing in order to get them ready for 18 or 19? And just pray through that and work on those things. And, especially in your teen years, there's so many things. It's a very different phase of life in the sense that with little children, you want to protect them from the evils of the world. With teenagers, you want to expose them to those things, but in a controlled way, where you are with them, where you are seeing it from a vantage point that it's not, they're not, going to be, it's not safe for them. It's in a safe way. Because the thing is that when they do go off on their own, you're sending them into a very harsh world out there. If you have not given them any exposure, they're going to be in trouble. They are really going to be in trouble if they have no concept for that world out there, especially if you're homeschooling. I know a lot of you homeschool. And so they're in very protected environments, and it's important that they see this is what the world is like out there. And this is, as you said, the consequences for, you know, premarital sex. Oh, these women have babies. The consequences for really poor choice in who your partner's going to be, you know, women in shelters, the consequences of using drugs, you know, these kind of things are important for them, especially as they are getting into their mid and late teens. It's very important that they see some of these things. Then, also, as she mentioned, the working on their skills and the things there. I know a lot of you have your kids like in sports and things. You guys, that's all you do. But, you know, your child has some innate abilities, and, you know, look for those abilities and help put out the money to, let them have the classes, the sport, the art, the music, the drama, the dance, language, whatever it is, whatever they are good at and want to do, because it will totally enrich their lives. They will have more confidence because they have a skill. They will have a set of friends that also like that, that arena. And who knows? They may actually be able to use it in their future. You know, we lived in Germany, and so my kids were raised in German schools. So two of them got jobs when they, you know, came out of college. Their first job was for MySpace, you know, working with the German connection. You know, that three of them actually have done jobs where they use their German. But, you know, my daughters loved art, and we were a music and art family, not a sports family. And, but they loved art, and, several of them majored in art. One of them was really, really good. And my daughter, Emily, and, you know, we gave her, we paid money to have her take art classes, and, she loved it. She majored in art, and today she works for Disney in animation. She paints on a screen, you know, and so you don't know, you know, but when they have those abilities, you know, you're granting them a true gift to let them do something that they were really good at. Now they may try something and say, no, this is not for me. One of my daughters, wanted to play the violin. And so, you know, we got her violin lessons. And after a while, you know, I think she did it for 2 years maybe. And then, no. And, but then she wanted to have a guitar. We got her a guitar, and to this day, she writes songs, you know. And she, you know, so it's, you were giving them something that they can have for lifelong, you know. So we want to expose them, to just, you know, all kinds of things. They need to see the world as a place to minister. So, you know, have your family, you know, be the homeless, you know, go do things, ministries, have them come alongside you. One of my greatest loves is, you know, I sing on the worship team sometimes, and I love seeing the children who come and help do the setup. Now there's a bunch of kids there that are just there. They're still too little and they just play around when they get there. But there are some of the boys particularly, because it seems to be like a boy thing, that actually are helping. And that is really a good thing. It's a really good place for them to be, because they see the men doing it, because they're getting a vision of, okay, I can do something. And even if I'm 10, I can do it and help. And they really do help. I see them and they know what they're doing. And then practical skills. You can teach your teen to be independent with their practical skills. Have them, train them to do their own laundry, train them how to clean, train them how to cook, train them how to do their finances. I had to do this in particular because we were in Germany. My kids were coming back to go to college in LA. And so they didn't have us and they didn't have anybody else either. And so, I had to teach them. I had them cook one night a week and I was a supervisor, and they, you know, they chose the menu and I helped them chop things and stuff, but it was their meal that they put on. When we didn't do very well with the first two kids, sending them off to college, about as the finances piece, because in Germany it's a cash or a bank transfer society. And they didn't write checks and they didn't use debit cards. And, what we did though with the younger two, and it worked beautifully, is about ninth grade, we got them, opened the bank account, got them an ATM card, put, their allowance and money for like something for clothes every month, you know, whatever that percentage is going to be. And then something for the, all those times that they come and ask you for 10 bucks. Remember doing that to your parents? And then they had to manage, you know, it might be 50 bucks or something. I don't know, $75. I don't know what it is today, but, and also I was in a different place, but then they have to manage their money, and it's a small amount of money. They don't have a credit card. They just have this little bit of money to manage. And we discovered that our kids actually were much more careful with spending their money than spending our money. And it worked really, really well. And it made them feel very grown up, and they got to make those choices. That was a much, they saw it as a very independent thing. So it really, I highly recommend it. It sounds kind of wild, you know, who does that, you know, but you're dealing with very small amounts of money. And if you have somebody who doesn't know how to manage their money very well, they may even get some overdrafts. But that's good, because then they have to maybe work for you to do something to earn the money so that they can put that money in the bank. And that will teach them. These are all, you know, you want the natural consequences to teach them about how to, you know, grow in these things. Oh gosh, we're almost done. Okay. Make space to talk to your teens. In our society, it's really difficult to, have time in, especially a place like Los Angeles. If you have relatives who live out in the country somewhere or live overseas somewhere, it goes slower. Time is slower, but not here. And so it's very easy just to be go, 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 the whole family, but your teens need to have time to talk to you. And so you've got to have some space where you're home and where they can actually find you to talk to you, because talking is very important to teens, not at every moment, but when they need to. I will give you an example. When my kids were young, I would read to them, this is in Germany, on the bed and we would all line up along the headboard, and I'd be in the middle and I'd hold the book out like this and I'd read to them, and they were, you know, like this. My kids were stair steps. They were like 4, 7.5 years from the oldest to the youngest. Well, by the time we were there, the oldest was a little too old. She was the tween. And, so she'd kind of hang out in the, right outside the door to listen, but she was too old to sit there. Then she'd come in after we were done. And so we would read, and then they might have a pillow fight, or who knows what happened after that. But that was mom time with them. And what happened was, little by little, they would sort of get older, and, I would read to the younger ones, and then I would just stay there and I would read. The older ones started coming in and flopping on the bed and just want to hang out because they knew I was there. They knew I wasn't going anywhere. They knew I was going to be available. And they just started talking. We had so many conversations about life on the bed, sitting on the bed. And it's because it was like they just knew that was a space that I had available. I wasn't going to give it to somebody else, and that they could talk all they wanted and talk about something that happened. And we had wonderful conversations. And then, of course, they all got to that stage, and they all, you know, did that. I told my husband, you know, at some point, I keep office hours after dinner on my bed. I never told them that. But it was true. So make some space. oh gosh, I'm going to have to cut some of this. Let teens make mistakes and take the natural consequences. That's really a big one. Another story of this is my daughter. I have one daughter who was in an embassy school, and she had a lot of her classmates, a lot of them were children of ambassadors, so they had money, and we didn't. We were missionaries. And so some of them were huffing, and she was trying to get them to stop. She was a Christian, you know. She was already had really made her own, you know, commitment there. And she was trying to get them to stop, but they kept telling her, "But you don't know. You've never done it. You don't know. You've never done it. You don't know. You've never done it." Huffing is where they're sniffing paint or aerosol or something. It's a cheap way to get high. It's also very dangerous. Not good for you. So they just kept after her. You don't know. Don't talk to us. You don't know. So finally one day she did it. She says, "Okay, I'm going to do it one time." She felt terrible. She just was devastated. And she was so devastated that she came to us and she just cried and cried. And she had already, by the time she told us, she had already gone in front of her class, which was a very small class. And she said, "You know, it was wrong of me to do this, and you should not be doing this either." And I wasn't there. I don't know exactly, but I know that she apologized and she said, "You know, I don't ever want to do this again." And she never did. But my point of this is that those were her natural consequences. We didn't ground her. We didn't do anything. We held her and we supported her and we said, "It's okay. You know, this is a good lesson learned. You're going to be okay. We just will go forward. We'll be, you know, it'll be all right." You know, she already had made the switch that she needed to make. We didn't need to ground her in addition to that. That was pointless. She had her natural consequences. She had her punishment, so to speak. And it was pretty significant. Choose your battles. Especially the older teens. Choose your battles. Don't battle hair color. You know, every generation has whatever their little things are, the way their silliness. You know, right now you see lots and lots of different hair colors. You know, jello red, and, you know, I mean, even older people are doing it now. That's kind of become more acceptable. But, you know, whatever it is that your generation of kids are into, if it's not, you know, something that is a biblical principle, don't sweat it. If it's a biblical principle, yes, do that battle. You know, be the bad guy when they want to go to a party that's unchaperoned, there's going to be alcohol. Have those conversations about what happens at those kind of parties. The police show up. possible alcohol poisoning, possible rape. I've counseled several women who were raped at those kind of parties. It's pretty devastating. So just don't battle everything, because it's only going to wreck your relationship. Only battle the things that are truly worthy of the stand that you need to take. And the last one, know your teen and be their cheerleader. It says that train up a child in the way that they should go. Know them. Know their love language, how they understand to be shown love. If there are like an acts of service, then you know are you guys all familiar with love languages? Okay. My oldest is acts of service, and so you know, I sent her my grandson Easter eggs, and I know that ministered to her because I was actually doing an active thing, as opposed to, you know, the physical touch or something like that. But everyone's different, and each of your children are going to be different too in how they receive that love, and how their giftings and all the different things. They're all going to be different, and they're all going to experience their parents differently. And be their cheerleader. Be the people who are the most excited about everything that they are doing. And then finally, you know, you really find a lot of principles from Proverbs. You know, you can study Proverbs with your teens. And there's so many principles there, you know, about anger, about, folly, about people without sense, about youth, and just, you know, there's a lot of things about youthful lusts, and in the New Testament you see that a lot too, about the struggles, you know, that youth have, but they also have strength, and there's a lot. They will come through these years, and you may not recognize them one day to the next. They can, you know, have this warm, wonderful conversation, and the next day something happened at school and they don't want to talk. And so you just got to go with the flow and keep calm. A gentle answer turns away wrath, and harsh words stir up strife. Your reaction to whatever they're doing, keep your words calm. And it really, you know, does decrease, things, and bite your tongue when they're telling you about their friend that does this horrible thing they did, and you're thinking, they're the friend, are they going to go do it too? Bite your tongue. Let them talk and try and just have a calm conversation and not accuse them of something that they haven't done. Because the minute you start reacting and you're going to bring up their defenses, and they are not going to have that conversation with you in the future. You have to try and keep it down. Pretend like you're talking to somebody else's teenager, because you would never get with somebody else's teenager. So try and talk to them in that way, that that you can keep it calm, keep it low, and then you keep the communication open for whenever they're ready. So I think that's about it. All we have to
When I said don't tighten the grip, that is going to be, I mean, maybe you all won't have that response, but when you realize that you're handing this very illogical, erratic being more and more decision-making and responsibilities, there's also something in my head that goes, oh no, I just need to hold on, because they clearly can't even decide if they should jump out of that tree at 8 feet, you know, kind of thing. That's what I was talking about, is that you want to control their environment way too tight, and you've got a bit, you give them more and more open boundaries. I saw that backfire on us multiple times when we were still holding it tight and we should have been letting it go. But I also saw the good results when we gave them the freedom, and they may have done real well, or they just bit it, and we kind of helped them get back up and get going again. How to ride a bike. You can't hold on to the bike the whole time. You just can't. You've got to let go at some point and know that they're going to, you know, good chance they're going to crash and burn at least once while they're learning how to do it.
Christian parents, I think the have a strong tendency in these early teen years to hang on. And we were talking, both of us, our households, we did that as parents. We hung on too long because we didn't have training like this. At least I didn't where I was. And then at the other end, I've seen Christian parents who, you know, their kid was in the spring year of their senior year in high school, and they're still telling them what movies to watch and they can't, which ones they can't watch. And if they really thought about it, they'd realize, you know, 4 months down the road, they're going to be on campus and their parents are not going to know what they watch. So they need to self-censor, you know, they need to train them to do it themselves and not to expect that they are going to, have to do these exact little detailed things, you know, at that age.
Yeah. One of the big things that I was saying, talk to them and answer the questions is you're no longer saying you need this because mom, that your dad and I told you to, but it's the why. That's legitimate. You need to be, before they're asking, you need to start giving the why. The reason I ask you to do or not do this or take, you help them understand, because they've got to have principles to operate up, not just methods.
Right.
So they need principles to operate up.
You both talked about natural consequences, which I think is really helpful. I was wondering, when is the time for, say, unnatural consequences? Like, this decision didn't, say, affect just me that I forgot my jiu-jitsu belt and had to do 50 push-ups for that. Mm-hmm. But maybe it affects our family because you're not, like, taking care of responsibilities like getting at home or something like that. Like, where is the kind of, like, boundary between this is all natural consequences
particularly,
versus, like, hey, you need some other consequences?
Yes, particularly when it affects other members of the family. You need to be very aware of that and sensitive to that. My kids literally had to come to me and basically said, Mom, you're not being fair because so-and-so is doing this over and over again, and it impacts all of us. And you're not real. What they were saying was, you're not letting the consequences fall hard enough on him for her to change his behavior. And I thought, they're right. And so, boy, I just started hands off and then adding. One of my favorite friends during seminary years, she had the most creative ways to help get her kids' attention about bridging the gap. When they leave a gap, here's the responsibility, here's the end result, and they didn't get to there, they left the gap. Somebody has to fill it, and usually it's one of us or their siblings. And so she would say, when they didn't finish their responsibility, I'm so glad you gave me the opportunity to give you another chore. I think I need the living room vacuum right now. Mom, I was going to go, well, I'm so sorry. But see, I spent 10 minutes fixing what you didn't finish or your sibling did. And so you're going to vacuum the floor for me or you're going to go clean their room. Like she would give them extra consequences for they're leaving that gap. And boy, she goes, there are days when my house is so clean, I am so proud. And I just laugh. And she goes, there are other days when the only thing you get done is me. And I'm also very glad about that too. Because she knows that they're getting the message. It's about their responsibility. There are unnatural consequences you add on when you see that it's impacting them. And one of the reasons I left that particular child at the high school. Because he was affecting his siblings and not, you know. So. Or didn't take a paper up multiple times. One of the children, several of them actually. They couldn't carry whatever they had from that bedroom to the front door and into the car. I don't know where. What happened. And I gave him grace. Up and hand them things or bring their lunch, whatever it was, project, and then I would give them a warning. You know, this is on you. This is your responsibility. And you're taking time out of my schedule or your sibling whom I'm taking care of to come up there and do this. And it would be, well, but Mom, if you don't do it, I'm going to get a little gray. Well, that's not a big deal. I'm like the bigger things. What happens? and help them understand this isn't just punishment. I'm trying to help you understand how they're, again, to be a blessing to others. Glorify God, be a blessing to others. You are not a blessing to your siblings right now because this is what, let's walk through this. What are you doing when you, what is happening then when you, whatever, are late to school because you can't find your underwear, whatever it is.
I just realized your answers are not good. You need probably one of these.
Or if you don't even care that you have underwear on, your siblings are absolutely mortified that they have to ask you to even have underwear. Some of my kids took me longer to realize there was an importance to underwear.
I have a question about the general thoughts about cell phones, let's say tablets too, but like in the mid teen years, or just in the teen years in general, honestly, pre-19, the general, like,
I think the bigger question is whether they have the internet on their phone.
Well, yeah.
That not having the internet on their phone in the younger years is probably a good idea. And just having the phone and texting ability. So they can text their friends and stuff like that, but the, and I don't know, do the nanny things work on the phones too? I don't know. I would say all the devices, having nannies on there would probably be helpful too.
There are apps to monitor.
Pardon?
I know, like Daniel, for a second, you have a phone now, which we were not for 10 years old.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
It was like one day no phone, next day phone. So there are definitely things you can do, but there's also equally Daniel isn't around anything, but it is truly locked it down. I felt like as I looked into it, I agree on that. But I think it's even gone far beyond like apps that control things. I mean, once you're connected to the internet or once you have another data connection, it's like
it's Pandora's box, right?
Is what I'm saying. It's just dangerous. I started out that way when my son was younger, I would say like he was 11, I think, when I got a first like first phone, and it wasn't very like it had some limitations on it, but I did find that it was a big distraction, even if it was just games, you know, it's like rushing to want to finish something really quickly just to get to that. When it for me it was like I'm a parent, I want to make sure he's okay, like he can call me when he needs to work, people have. So I, like at this point, I the reason why I asked that, because at this point, I just completely eliminated it. He does have access if he needs to, like, do homework on Chrome, you know,
right,
on his device. But, and I know there's, there are certain phones, I think it's, Gab Wireless, that is just, you know, phone calls, text messages, some pictures, and maybe some music, but like the music is,
yeah, you don't have to have the internet.
Yeah.
You know, and for younger, it's better to not have it.
But I, because he's so smart. He's like, he's so brilliant. And these kids, like you said, there's ways around it.
Right.
And I just found that it was distracting him from like all the good that he was doing, all mm-hmm. his work and, you know, all his grades and everything. It was such a distraction. That was the only thing. The only thing, like not even his behavior, you know, aside from that, but I'm saying like, wasn't like lashing out or didn't have to worry about all this other stuff. That was it. That was what got to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remembered, well, when I was younger, I didn't have that. I mean, we all didn't, I think, mm-hmm. right? We didn't have that. So I don't think it's going to affect, I think the only way it affects him now is because he sees other kids and they have them. Yeah. They have them, and she kind of feels like, oh, I don't have that. So, but I think overall, I think it's the best decision I can make right now because it's distracting. Mm-hmm. Even when it's not his intention, he just thinks like, oh, it's accessible. I could get on here really quick. And she's like, no. It became disruptive. Mm-hmm. So I took it away. And I would like to get more of a, you know, film that's like something like the Gab phone. I think it's called the Gab something.
There's Gab, yeah. There's Pineal, there's Bark.
But Bark, I think, is like you attach that to your modem.
Well, Bark actually has a phone.
Oh,
it actually came out with a phone.
Okay.
So yeah. It'll monitor for like, and you can set the level that you want, like what kind of alerts you want. But it'll monitor like the story of Bark called. And they're like, we are very concerned with the text you saw your son send. The son is about to go out to live and kill his son. And Bark called the mom and said, go get your son now. Like it monitors the text so that you don't have to read them yourself. So your child can have freedom, but someone's monitoring the texts so that, as I see Karen holding the mic towards me.
just want to make sure that maybe we can hear
these.
That's a little creepy.
It's like a system. It's not like a person, but there's alerts so that the parent can go and then have the conversation, like, and start the what's going on and, like, feel, like, tackle the bridge, like, tackle the conflict. There are phones that, and it limits the internet, and I think it, like, you can slowly increase it, like, the building the freedom. Because, again, once he gets a job and can go buy his own phone, you can't control that.
Yes.
Right. Yes. But it allows that slow, gradual increase.
So this has been, going on for maybe, like, a year, and I feel like I've seen a lot of progress. I think he's also like been self-aware and like said, yeah, you know, this is a huge distraction. So I do think there's success behind what I ultimately ended, because I was so like, yeah, you know, like they need a Chromebook, they have to get connected online, they have to do their, you know, they have to use the phone, but then you don't really realize like a phone is literally a connection to the internet. And it's not sometimes them doing something that's wrong. It's what comes to them.
Yes.
Like these games and all this stuff.
And yes.
There's no there's no real protection for them. You know, it's just about the money and everything else. Yeah. So, anyways, I felt like I had to go extreme. Not so much because it was he's a bad kid or anything like that. It's just because of the access. And when he first had access, it was at a public school. And so they give him this Chromebook, and then there's limitations, but there really isn't, like they can get around that. So that was my thing, because I sometimes feel bad. And when he still has access, he has to, you know, get online. He's taking you know, college courses on online, so he has to have access. But it was just like, I think that phone, they'd be carried everywhere, and they were just like, distracted. So I felt bad, you know, for some time, but now I'm like, I've stuck to my guns, and I think he's been able to understand that more and be more respectful, like with me in front of his screen. But if I were to, you know, use the phone, I think I'd want it to be more restrictive, you know, something like this, just the calls and the text messages for communication. Because again, when they get older, but I feel like, okay, then by that time I'm like, okay, because he's going to be able to, you know, manage it and be able to control, have more control. Then I think it's too much power. I'm saying, like, one, it's just too much power for these formative years, and it's just really sucking a lot of the kids up. Like they're just sucked up into this.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Just so any of you that need to go can go, cause if that's right, we're way past. And so I just wanted to give you freedom to do that. And there are going to be some things where in your heart of hearts, you're convinced that this particular area, you want to have some boundaries. Just a quick example for me was, I grew up in the Midwest, and you know, everything was fried, battered, gravied, et cetera. And I love my food. I love fried chicken, and I loved, but as I became a mom and I was just kind of stepping back and looking at my menu things, I thought, you know, I started researching more and reading more about nutrition and everything. And I had even nutrition courses in college because I was interested in it. And I thought, you know what? I think part of raising my children is not just the spiritual, emotional, everything, but also just physically making sure that when they get exercise, they're physically fit, you know, as much as they can be. And also I feed them well because I'm literally growing their future by how they eat. This was just my person. I'm not trying to put this anybody else. But when they got to that tween years and they were going to other people's houses, you go, do they? No, they have this, and this, and this, and this. They have it all the time. This is what we have for dinner. This is what they have for breakfast. And I said, I am aware of that. Where is it at our house? And then so I had conversations about why I didn't buy it, why I didn't bring it. I said, there are things that I love eating that I don't buy anymore because I know I will eat it and it's not the best for me. Now, I'm not saying we can't have fun. We can't splurge. We go on vacation and I'm not going to restrict what you have another person's home, but will you be part of an experiment? I want you to, as a habit, eat the kind of food that I'm making for you, that I'm offering to you. This was like seventh and eighth grade particularly. And then I want you to, when you hit high school, I want you to kind of look around at your friends. And I was basically doing a Daniel experiment with them, you know, just, you know, lots of fresh fruit and vegetable. You look around at your friends and you look at you and you ask yourself, is there anything different? Do you notice any changes? And I didn't even have to say anything. You know, a lot of the friends they didn't see, maybe most of the summer they were gone and we had different schedules and me and a ministry, we'd go to, you know, different places. But anyway, I could not believe one by one they would come in and say to me, Mom, remember Aaron? Well, of course I remember Aaron. He was over all the time. Oh my gosh. And they start describing what he looked like now as compared to when they saw him back in eighth grade, or this person or that person. And I said, well, see, because now what they've been eating for the last 14 years is now playing itself out in how they look and probably how they feel and how they're going to think and their energy and all that kind of stuff. And so sometimes you just have to say, would you be willing to lean into this, what I believe is a biblical good thing to do, and experiment? And it's not like we don't have junk food. It's not like I'm just saying we asked as a pattern, can you just fill yourself up with things that are good for you? Can you cooperate with me? And so yeah, that's kind of like you're talking about, you know, sometimes there's things out there and, you know, they're really fun, they're good, but should we set, you know, a limitation on really how good is good, and where's the line for each of us, for our families? Or if, you know, for me, my mom could have been such a blessing to me by saying, you cannot have any sugar any of your life while you're growing up, because I have an addiction that is terrible, and I will fight it till the end of my days because I love sugar. And why? Because I love sugar, but also I was allowed to have it, you know, not all the time, but enough that, so that's just, yeah, on that. Just gonna make sure.